Welcome to What is Going Om for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello, and welcome to part two of a three-part series on the Revelations Trilogy, written by internationally acclaimed astrologer, ceremonial teacher, and Mayan calendar researcher, Barbara Hand Clow, the author of numerous best-selling non-fiction books, including The Pleiadian Agenda, Alchemy of the Nine Dimensions, and Awakening, the Planetary Mind. Barbara Hand Clow's first foray into fiction is an intricately layered, fact-filled, erotic thriller that reveals esoteric teachings on prophecy, power, ritual, divination, the mysteries of divine marriage, sacred sexuality, the Black Madonna, and the transformative power of holy relics. Barbara Hand Clow, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Sandy. Good to see you.
You too. Book two, Revelations of the Aquarian Age, published in 2018, opens with the wedding of the mysterious aristocratic painter Armando, whose family have strong ties to the Vatican, and Jennifer, his soon-to-be wife, who is sister of the journalist Simon Appel. Formerly a rather dark, if not evil, character, Armando has had something of a spiritual awakening in the 3 years since the previous book came out. So tell us the story from here.
Well, in the Ruby Crystal, Armando was a really bad guy, and I describe many adventures of Armando. But then as we come into Revelations of the Aquarian Age, he is entering into the very, very early stages of becoming what I would call a normal human being. And then as we go along, he ends up transforming a great deal. But as we open Aquarian Age, we start with his wedding. And what's happening for him is he's bonding for the first time with a woman in a really authentic way. And then what happens for him all the way throughout Aquarian Age is he starts growing and changing and developing psychologically. And I have to say, Sandy, that I've only realized recently, rereading the book again, how much really is a channeled book. It's like Armando really just came in, and I guess most fiction must be channeled. I haven't really understood that, but what came through Armando just came from such a pure, exciting place for me that I just was able to somehow really unleash the story of his development. And that's really, he's really the lead character of Aquarian Age, I would say.
Yeah. Well, after his wedding, he reveals his symbolic painting of the love between Jesus and Mary Magdalene to his bride, Jennifer. And this is a painting that, you know, has an amazing impact on people. What is so special about it?
Well, I think what happened, and he even talks about it with his wife at one point, but I think something happened in the bonding for Armando himself with the sacred feminine that allowed a very, very high vibration of that teaching come through him. And of course, the teaching that comes through him is the whole story of the marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, which is a very potent archetype for our times. But I loved the way their bonding caused this to happen for him. At the time it happened, they'd probably been married, I'd say, 4 or 5 months, something like that. And he was busy painting triptychs, which are paintings on three levels for expensive galleries in Rome. He was on the verge of having a big show. And suddenly he couldn't paint those paintings anymore. He just became absolutely obsessed with this image that needed to come in. So finally, in utter desperation, he just let it happen. And what we got was this incredible painting that actually does depict the real presence of Christ. Now, of course, this is fictional. So this painting doesn't really exist. This painting, it was all in my imagination. And then recently I just discovered a painting that was painted during the Renaissance. It's actually very similar. I was quite surprised by that. It isn't the same painting by any stretch of the imagination, but quite similar. But what it shows is it shows the power of Jesus's, and I'm going to refer to him as Jesus, even though I used the word Christ a minute ago, because the Christ archetype is the global archetype that affects everybody on the planet one way or another. But we're talking about Jesus as a man. And in the painting, he's desperately attempting to ascend beyond the earth. But what's holding him to the earth is the divine feminine. And then we have the depiction of Mary, who is desperately attempting to keep him here because she loves him and adores him. And it's a very powerful dynamic going on between the two of them.
And the painting, it says in the book, is something that when people look at it, they are going to have an awakening of their own. How does that happen through a painting?
Well, you know, for me, at least, it happens with lots of paintings. I find visual art one of the most potent transmitters of higher dimensional forces and information on the planet. But in this particular painting, it ends up being displayed in the de' Medici Chapel in Florence. And in the de' Medici Chapel, there's back rooms all over the place on the first and second floor that are filled with mysterious reliquaries. And reliquaries are beautiful boxes and pictures and stuff like that made by artists that have a place in them somewhere with a little glass receptacle where a bone can go. And so the reliquaries are art objects that display sacred bones. And so these are all over the place in the chapel. And when the people start coming to see the painting, what happens for them is they start awakening at a cellular level. And then some of the characters report buzzing in the reliquaries, light in the reliquaries, and even an occasional explosion of bees all the way throughout the Medici Chapel that are affecting the people. These are, of course, are in another dimension. They're not, if we had a bunch of bees attacking, they'd all run out, but these are in another dimension. And so the awakening is being tied to the issue of the bones of the family of Jesus. Because in the first novel in this trilogy, Revelations of the Ruby Crystal, we immediately see Simon Appel, the New York Times reporter, going after the Talpiot tomb in Jerusalem, the discovery of the Talpiot tomb, which is called the Jesus family tomb. And this tomb has been an incredible discovery in our lifetime, 1980s forward with scientific testing and everything, because this tomb, as far as major researchers know, contains the body of the family of Jesus, which would be Jesus, his brother James, there are other brothers and sisters, maybe his parents, I'm not sure about that, but also one of the ossuaries, the bone containers, showed evidence of somebody else's DNA, and that DNA is Mary Magdalene. And of course, what would happen in a tomb like that is all of the people buried in it would carry the genes of the Jesus family, except, of course, the wife of Jesus. There's a child in there, too, that has DNA combined.
And this is real.
Yes, this is real.
This is real.
The background material all the way throughout this trilogy is not only scientifically correct and correctly described, but also I give references to who wrote the major sources on these issues. And quite a few people are following up on some of those sources.
So many people think that Mary Magdalene went to France and is buried there somewhere.
Right. And she may have after some period of time after he... Now, there's another whole issue lurking behind this trilogy that I did not go after, which is a lot of people think Jesus did not die on the cross and that he was healed and saved and that he was a teacher in the Far East for 30 years after the supposed crucifixion. I tend to think that is true. And I've been researching it for many, many years. But it would have taken this whole trilogy way beyond where it could possibly go. So there's the issue of your question was. I lost the thread there because
I said about Mary Magdalene being buried in France.
Excellent, in France, right? Exactly. You know, I've read, of course, deeply into all of these issues. And there's a lot of evidence that Jesus was at Glastonbury at one point. There's a lot of issues around Jesus traveling in France and traveling up in England and various locations. So to me, it wouldn't be surprising at all that if they, maybe, who knows, maybe they separated. After all, we just hear that the Canadian premier and his wife were separating. It happens all the time. And you're right, exactly. So maybe Mary was up there. Maybe she was up there as a healer and a teacher, because after all, she was an apostle, according to best information we can get. Maybe Jesus was in the East teaching, and maybe she was up there. I don't know. But I do think there's a lot of evidence for her in France.
But this painting, you know, tells the story, doesn't it? I mean, in medieval times, all of the paintings were full of symbology. They all told stories, but not everybody understood what they were looking at. But a lot of the truth is actually in those paintings.
Right, that's true. And even more specifically, the painters were often, if not always, initiates of secret orders and the Templars and various mystical orders. And so the painter often became a painter because he had secret information. And then the painter depicted some of the secrets in art. And so in the painting that Armando painted, now first of all, when he painted it, he just went into a total altered state. He was just like completely taken over by this powerful force. And there's a rock behind him where he's kind of kneeling. And there's a golden bee on it, a very prominent golden bee. And everybody who looks at this painting says, well, why is that bee there? Well, the bee is a very, very deep esoteric symbol for the goddess, because the bee is the symbol of Artemis, the goddess of the hunt and the goddess of the earth. And so what has happened here is Armando has, you know, painted this bee. He doesn't know why it's there. At one point, he almost painted over it, but fortunately, he didn't. And it turns out that that bee is a big key to a lot of the secret teachings coming through in this trilogy.
And in the book, you have the six friends who are the main characters after viewing the painting, explore how the Knights Templar collected the bones of the Jesus family from the Talpiot tomb in Jerusalem and eventually placed them in reliquaries throughout the world. Is that part true? You know, are there reliquaries in the Medici Chapel in Florence that actually we know contain their bones?
Yeah, well, what comes out through the novel is the issue of where these reliquaries are. And two of the characters have major reliquaries of their own. And so this thread is followed all the way through, because this all starts for me with my research on the Talpiot tomb in Jerusalem, which is mostly described in Ruby Crystal. And the facts are, the tomb of the family of Jesus has been discovered and analyzed and studied. And nobody knows about this, or some people do. People like you and me know about this. This is outrageous. This would be like discovering maybe the tomb of Solomon for the Jewish people. This is a huge deal. So I went deeply into it. And the more deeply I got into it, the more I started looking at it from my own point of view. I started digging up things outside the published books and brought them in. And it's very, very clear to me, and I do describe this, that during the purpose of the Crusades, basically, was for the Christians to get in there and to get into that tomb. And then once they got into that tomb, then they collected the bones, not all of them, I don't think, we don't know, because there's evidence that somebody got into this tomb during the time of the Crusades, clear evidence. And then what happens is there's another whole level of different soil on top of the soil in the tomb after the Crusades. So we know somebody got in there, and that's just a fact. And what we do, so I drew my own conclusions. I just said, why is everybody venerating all these bones all over the place? I mean, if you get deep into Catholicism, and I've seen some relics that are almost just too much to even look at, but they're really, really into skulls and bones and all. Why are they so much into that? And why were people especially paying so much money for these bones and these reliquaries all the way throughout the last 1,000 years or something like that? So I came to the conclusion that there was a lot of meaning in this. And then, of course, the next place I went with it was the issue of, like, well, in terms of modern times, why would anybody put any kind of value into bones? It's called DNA. And so I really do think that the Templars got the bones out of the tomb, venerated the tomb. And by the way, in the second level of the soil in the Taltiat tomb, somebody deposited three skulls in a triangular formation back around 1100 AD. Now, the Templars' basic symbol is skull and bones. So, of course, the first thing I think of is this must have been some kind of Templar ritual that they carried out at that time. And I lost my train of thought again. It's headed for
the fact of the three skulls in that formation.
Oh, I know what. I lost my train of thought because I'm about to say something that I probably should say on the air, but I'm going to say it anyway. I've studied the Masonic 33 degrees. I'm not a Mason. I don't join groups. I have no opinion, no judgment one way or the other about the Masons. I just don't know, or the Templars either. But the facts are, in the 14th degree of the Masonic rituals, there's a whole thing going on with a triangle of three skulls. In other words, that this, what the Masons did, as far as we can tell, in their degree, what happens with the Masonic ritual is each one of the degrees has specific ancient historical information and symbolism. And then the Masons are taught to go through these rituals in order to imprint historical information that the Masonics think is important to remember. And so for some reason, the Masons' 14th degree is a ritual that involves the three skulls in a triangular formation. Now, you know, you put two and two together, and the fact that the archaeologists dug up three skulls in the upper level of the soil in this tomb, and you can't escape the fact that this is a long lineage of protection for the importance of these bones. And then our characters, of course, are modern people, and they're going, well, what are you going to do with that? And in the novel, people are starting to wonder about DNA testing of these bones.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you said that, you know, you can look at pictures and you can have experiences, transformative experiences. And this is what happened to, you know, the people who looked at this particular painting. And many people think that, you know, all of these ancient bones have some kind of magical power, some kind of alchemy. What do you think is actually happening there that creates that transformative experience with people? Is it mind over matter?
Okay, this is a hard one to answer, but what art does for people, and certainly for me, is art opens all nine dimensions of consciousness. If we contemplate a painting deeply, we have access to either all of the dimensions. Lots of paintings I find access one or two of the higher dimensions. There's five higher dimensions, fifth dimension through the ninth. And some paintings access all of them. And I would say that the painting that is I depict fictionally that Armando brought in is bringing in nine dimensions of consciousness. And the reason I think so is the people who are being moved and transformed by the painting are going into a very, very high altered state. Very high altitude.
And Armando's, kind of redemption from being quite evil to having this spiritual awakening, is that a result of the sacred sex that he starts to have with his wife? Because for the first time, as you said, that he's actually bonding with someone and almost, bonding with the goddess within her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm working with sacred sex all the way throughout the trilogy, because I believe it was a form of creativity and contact with divine levels that existed in probably all ancient cultures until as recently as only 500 years ago, but certainly 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 years ago. Sacred sex was just part of the way that people could contact divine levels of consciousness. And if you think about it, what's really behind the story of Armando and Jennifer in this novel is their breakthrough to sacred sex. And then I'm doing it with all of them. But it's breaking through to what the human is actually capable of. And the novels do not particularly deal with what happens when people, men and women or two women or whatever, discover sacred sex. But I think that sacred sex is actually it's basically the thing that humans do for the planet. And we could see that when we go back 5,000 years. If we go back to the rituals where people couples would go out into the fields in September during the harvest or in the spring when the generation was starting. And couples would have sacred sex, and in temples also, in order to actually fertilize the planet. And for me, now I'm part Cherokee and I grew up with an indigenous training as a child, that I'm very comfortable with this. And then I freely admit I've been wonderfully happily married to one wonderful person for 50 years. And that has been a significant part of our experience and our planetary gifting. And I think, look at the condition we're in at this point. That we have really lost the connection to that issue and that way of living. And so the trilogy has a lot of erotic sex in it in order to bring back the power of this type of consciousness.
Yeah. Well, people misunderstand some of those words, sacred sex and, erotic, and they think, oh, it's very salacious, when the fact is it's very holy.
Well, we're back to nine dimensions of consciousness again. When sex is very lusty and very basically extremely physical, it's operating at the lower dimensional levels, the first, second, and third dimension. And that's okay. But one of the reasons for all of the teachings about marriage and sacred family relationships and everything has been that these are the most potent forces that we humans can get in touch with. And so right now we're living at a time when basically sex is pornographic. And sex has, for me, never did and never will and never has had anything to do with pornographic levels of consciousness. So sacred sex isn't necessarily even intercourse. Sacred sex can operate with energetic connections between people that are basically non-sexual and working in higher dimensions. So sacred sex defined would be all of those levels from the first dimension in the center of our planet all the way to the highest dimensions of divine forms of consciousness. And then some people may hear me and they go, well, what about God? God to me is the divine force of the whole universe and the whole cosmos. I'm very, very much a deep believer. And I also believe that Jesus is part of the expression of divine consciousness on this planet. Not for everybody, but certainly we can say that Jesus has been a teacher for many, many people, not just Christians, Islamic people, many, many other people feel this energy coming in. The light of Christ.
Can you tell me what is the significance of the Black Madonna? We hear so much about the Black Madonna, but nobody really knows much about it.
Well, that's really a tough one, isn't it? I've thought about that one a lot. And she may have the original goddesses on the planet, a lot of them were probably Black. So that could certainly just be the basic reason. But I think it's to link the goddess with the earth and the darkness and depth of the earth. And that's why Black people have a very powerful sacred force just by their nature, because they're connected with this teaching by means of color. And that's really all I can imagine saying about it. You know, it's a mystery. It's impenetrable. We could go almost anywhere with it.
I was surprised to find, I'm doing a little bit of research on it, that nobody is doing any research.
Nobody what?
That just seems odd. Nobody is doing any research on the Black Madonnas. You would think that somebody would be looking more deeply into this, but nobody is.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, and another thing is, last time we were in Europe, Jerry and I started looking for her everywhere. Whenever we were in a Catholic church or anything, we would look at all the Madonnas. And we started finding Madonnas that nobody has ever even listed. She's all over the place.
Yeah.
So it's. I think you could say it represents a teaching school of some sort. And it's not one that I know anything about.
Mm, yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I want to get into some really deep stuff in the book. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. And my guest today is internationally acclaimed astrologer, Mayan calendar researcher, and best-selling author, Barbara Hanclough. And we're discussing book two of her explosive part fiction, part factual revelations trilogy. We'll be back with more from Barbara Hanclough after this break.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times' flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked what's really worth reading and what's not. So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who have walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS, just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios, and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo, and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club, get inspired, and save money at the No BS Spiritual Book Club.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Barbara Hanclough, many people might say, why bother with this story from the past? I know the answer to that because I've read the books, but would you tell our viewers?
Yeah, I don't think that we can get into the now, which is the current moment, without having an accurate model of the past. And all of my 20 books or whatever has been dealing with the last, especially the last 12,000 years of human consciousness and history. But I even go back as far as 100,000 years. And I know that an incorrect story has been promulgated by means of the media, by means of literature, by means of writing. There's a big cover-up that's been going on that has been especially intense basically since the beginning of the age of science, the last 400 or 500 years. And I cover this topic, by the way, in a book that came out in 2001 called Catastrophobia, which means fear of catastrophes. And that book has been retitled Awakening of the Planetary Mind. But the basic theme of catastrophobia is that for the last 12,000 years, we have been a multi-traumatized species because a great cataclysm occurred in our solar system and on our planet around 12 to 13,000 years ago. And then what happened after that was a long period of amnesia. And then gradually cultures started waking up and developing again. And this actual story has been hidden basically in our times until a guy came along named Emmanuel Velikovsky, who wrote a bunch of books on various cataclysms. And when the Velikovsky's books came out, they sold millions of copies. He was completely shunned by science. His publisher was threatened with being shut down if they didn't stop publishing him. There was a complete blackout on his works, which did not succeed. It's similar to some of the stuff that's been going on the last 3 years with COVID. And so we're more sensitive now to what it's like to be living on a planet where half of the story is blotted out and we can't figure out what's going on, which is very frustrating. And so I wrote Catastrophobia in order to show that we are a multi-traumatized species that's waking up now. And I do believe that is proving to be true. But the point would be, Sandy, that as long as your story of the past, for example, was Jesus a celibate and was his mother a virgin when he somehow appeared? Or was he a married man with a family and a great teacher who inspired the human race? It makes a great deal of difference in our current now, what we think about that and what we know about that. It's just one example. So in order to create a future that we would want to freely choose and freely create, we need to understand the past in order to get into the present moment. And that's why I think our times are so difficult. We're moving out of that incorrect definition of the past, and we're starting to face up to the truth about a lot of things that have happened on this planet. And it's a very, very hard awakening.
Mm. You share a lot of this in your chapter, The Story of Time, when Armando's father, Pietro, is telling him, you know, how we've been fed a false story for so long. And he says that the story of human life in Italy for the last 50,000 years is recorded in Siena Cathedral.
First of all, this really was channeled. I didn't have any way of knowing any of that stuff. Once I bring something in, then I research it to see whether it's accurate or not. And to tell you the truth, a lot of the things in Aquarian Age are already coming through in basic discoveries. So what did it to me was spending time at Siena Cathedral. And Siena Cathedral is definitely a depiction of the real truth of the past. Now, who built the cathedral? The Catholic Church. So why would the Catholic Church build an edifice that's encoded with symbols and stories of the correct timeline when they basically are supporting the wrong timeline? Well, think of it this way. Think of Ireland. The Catholic Church had a real problem back in the 5th or 6th century when they started converting the Irish and really starting to destroy a lot of the Irish heritage. And they realized that they somehow had to save some of the Irish heritage because even the Vatican and the church would forget. So I think Siena Cathedral is a similar thing. I think Siena Cathedral is a record, like almost a museum of the correct timeline. And so the more I got into that, and of course I described that in the book, it's one of the most powerful places on this planet, by the way. I've been to many cathedrals, and it is really a powerful place.
Mm. Tell me, what is so important about the swan?
About the swan?
The swan. Pietro talks to his son Armando about the Paleolithic astronomical alignments to the swan constellation.
Oh, the swan. I thought you said the swamp. And I was going, did I get into the swamp? You know, get the swamp in Washington, right? The swan. Okay. On that one, again, I'm just bringing in everything I know. And the research that supported what came through me the most is the research of Andrew Collins. And Andrew Collins is a wonderful British writer who's written many, many wonderful books. I admire him very much. And he wrote a book called The Cygnus Mystery. And it's Andrew Collins's understanding of the importance of the Swan constellation and Deneb, which is the main star. And so if we get into that research, we're going back to 17,000 years ago at the beginning of the age of Libra. And of course, my trilogy is very precessional, because I think one of the best ways to decode the past is to use precessional symbolism. So for example, all the way through the age of Aries from 2000 BC to 0 AD, everywhere, what do we find? The ram, and the ram is the symbol for Aries. The age before that, 2,000 to 4,000 BC, the age of Taurus, the bull. And so one of the ways you can figure out how old something is the kind of symbolism that it carries. So if we go way back 17,000 years ago, we find something really interesting. Something happened to the human race 17,000 years ago. And all anthropologists, including Carl Sagan wrote a lot about this one, say that something fundamentally changed 17,000 years ago. And there was a huge transformation of our species at that time. Well, as it turns out, there's some kind of astronomical phenomenon going on in Cygnus that causes the Earth to be showered with a lot of light particles, I think photons too. And so Pietro, Pietro Pierleoni is the Italian character, and his family carries the records of the swan mysteries that go back to 17,000 years ago. So first it came through Pietro, in that particular part of the text. I went into such an altered state that when I woke up, I didn't even know where I was. And it correlates with Andrew Collins. So I, of course, mentioned Andrew Collins in the text also. Whenever I found somebody who brought in similar information, I always credit them, because after all, they managed to get it. So characters, it's an interesting technique. I don't know if anybody's done anything like this, where like for instance, your book club. Well, this is a trilogy about really interesting characters who sit around and talk about things and then mention the books where they found it.
You know, there's so much truth in this book. That's what I find so fascinating about it. There is a part, if I can just read a little bit, that I thought was really important, where Pietro says to Armando that right now our planet is on the edge of destruction. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows it. Esoteric secrets must come to light now, because power mongers are grabbing everything left on Earth, since they think they can exhaust our planet and then fly to Mars. Yeah, well, we all know a lot of people who are doing that. They think money will save them, but we can't eat money. The only thing that can save Earth is remembering our true heritage, which always emerges for a while during the changes of the ages. And that is where we are right now. You know, this change of the ages.
Yeah, and that's why I wrote this trilogy.
Yeah.
Because I knew that the ultimate shift point, as it turned out when I examined it as an astrologer, was going to be March of 2020, which people now call the Great Reset. But what happens as we come closer and closer to the end of an age, and we get closer and closer to that, what I call kind of cracking point, what happens is more and more revelation starts coming in. And fortunately, I'm lucky. I'm a writer, and I've been researching and publishing throughout this whole period of kind of the deep dump of all the information from the past that we really need. But now we're into the really crux of the whole matter, because now we're into the point where we're into the now, and look at what it's like. It's so intense. The more you get into the now, the more intense things are. Just look at nature and look at the weather and everything. It's really incredible. So that's why I wanted to document this period of time. I felt like someday this is going to matter, you know?
Yeah.
And it may help some people right now. It certainly piqued readers who are reading it now. It's giving us a lot of food for thought about what's actually happening to us. For example, going back to the issue of the cataclysms, 12.5 to 13,000 years ago, that's the opposite point in the precessional cycle to the entry into Aquarius. The cataclysms of the previous period started with the beginning of the age of Leo, and they go through the age of Leo. And now we're entering Aquarius. And so one of the reasons the planet is functioning the way it's functioning is we're at a critical point in the catastrophic cycle.
Yes, you say we are experiencing similar climate stress again, and remembering something in that cellular memory, you know, is being triggered. And this is what I think is, you know, the trauma that's buried there is responsible for so much of what we can't explain.
Yeah, and then luckily we have the research of Charles Hapgood. And Charles Hapgood was a geography teacher someplace in the eastern United States, like Maine or something like that. And he wrote the maps of the ancient sea kings. And Hapgood basically proved that Antarctica was ice-free 13,000 years ago. In other words, there's a brief period right after the Ice Age and before we went into the cataclysmic cycle where Antarctica was ice-free. So now there's a lot of signs that Antarctica is really melting. And so, yes, people have tremendous cellular memory. They have memory of, you know, of what some of these times feel like. But the only thing you can do is surrender. And yes, we can do, first of all, the environment, our human environmental issues are first, right? Well, then you'd think we'd be doing the important things like cleaning plastics out of the ocean and a whole lot of other things, a whole lot of environmental issues that have been strangling the planet, and we could do something, but that's not where the emphasis is going. And I'll be honest with you, I think the whole emphasis on excessive carbon in the environment is a distraction from having people realize that this is a cycle of nature. We're living in the middle of a cataclysmic cyclical time. And it's terribly difficult. But I don't want you to think I'm saying, oh, it's a cycle, I don't have to do anything. Oh, no, 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 no. There's so many things we should be doing that we're not doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, everybody thought, you know, the age of Aquarius was going to be so wonderful and we're all going to float around loving one another. And you talk about, you know, the part of our brain, the reptilian brain, is being triggered by Aquarius, by Aquarian rays.
As far as I can tell from studying precessional cycles, every shift from one gradation to another, the other, is extremely traumatic for around 200 years. And so we've had 100 years of it and we've shifted into Aquarius. We've got another 100 years to go. So even though Aquarius may ultimately offer some very positive things for us and for the planet, it's still a very traumatic transformation. And speaking of the great ages, as far as I can tell, the age of Libra, which is this cycle 17,000 years ago, when the human species went through a transformational development, then the age of Gemini, which is around 6,000 to 8,000 years, 5,000 to 7,000 years in that range, was an age of enlightenment. This is the age of Zoroaster, the original Zoroaster, and an age of, this is the period of Katahuyuk and some of the sacred sites that you find on the planet. So as far as I can tell, Sandy, the great ages that are air sign ages, which is Libra, Gemini, and Aquarius, tend to be ultimately ages of enlightenment. But the transformation into it is basically bloody hell. And we're there.
Yeah, we are there. I mean, you know, you've answered in the book some questions that I've had. You know, why are people behaving so badly? Why are we seeing so much, you know, you use the word atavism, you know, sexual abuse, murder, cannibalism. I mean, just absolute, as if people have no soul whatsoever. And that this is something that is a reversion to a survival period that we went through.
Yes, it is. It is definitely. And I just hope it doesn't get much worse, especially regarding children on this planet. But I do find personally that if I have some kind of an understanding of why things are the way they are, it does help. But they're going to be the way they are, whether I understand it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. The book offers readers a ninth dimensional initiation encoded within it. How do you encode a ninth dimensional initiation into the words that you're writing?
Well, are you referring to the initiation as in Sintra in Portugal at the end of Source? Or are we talking about Aquarian Age?
I'm talking about Aquarian Age.
Okay, because the main initiations actually are being conducted by Lorenzo Giannini. And Lorenzo Giannini is a famous Jungian analyst in Rome. And he just appeared one day. He appeared, all the characters in the book came in all together before I started. And then halfway through Ruby Crystal, Lorenzo Giannini appeared in my office. And I'm going like, who is this and what is going on here? It was really the most bizarre appearance I've ever experienced. And Lorenzo just simply said, I'm here to tell you that I've been analyzing Armando for the last 10 years. And what was funny about that, Sandy, is I didn't know that Armando had an analyst in Ruby Crystal. And so when we get into the Aquarian Age, the second book, then Armando is carrying out a series of initiations with characters in order to take them to the next level. And I think it's the most fun material in the book. And people say, well, how come those sessions are 20 minutes long? In the book, in order to describe them, it seems like they go really fast, but they actually take like 3 or 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have asked me about that. How come he can do it so fast? And I go, wait a minute. When you write about it, it has to look like it's moving along. But in actuality, there's hours and hours of a person going, you know how it is when you do sessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's a great analyst because he's operating very multidimensionally.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and his use of crystals and his knowledge Mm-hmm. So deep.
Yeah, that comes from, I'm a Cherokee crystal teacher. And so I decided in this trilogy, because I'm getting on there in years, I'm going to be gone one these days. And I decided to really offload my crystal knowledge. So Lorenzo is giving us the crystal teachings. And anybody can use crystals. Yes. You just have to decide to do it. They're wonderful. Like I have a great, I have one with me for all of your shows. A really nice, small, fairly small record crystal. And I use this just for our clarity between the two of us.
Yeah. Sex, it features prominently in the trilogy as alchemy, as abuse, as a form of control. And Armando, has a memory emerge of having been sexually abused by a priest as a child, which was probably, I think, was done partly on purpose because, a lot of people talk about sexual abuse of children is about shutting them down. It's about separating them from their soul and putting out their light. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also, in Aquarian Age, I really enjoyed the unfoldment of the relationship between William Adamson and Armando. And William is Sarah's father. And in the middle of the trilogy, he remembers what happened to him.
Yes.
So there's a lot of awakening of memory, which is how people bring it back and deal with it.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. You and I spoke about the sexual abuse in the church on the last episode. And I wake up this morning and I look at my news feed. And the first thing I see is that the Pope, on the first day of his 5-day visit to Lisbon for the Catholic Church's World Youth Day Festival, addressed the scandal facing the Portuguese Church and castigated the bishops, demanding that they respond better to victims by accepting them and listening to them. The report says that he met with 13 abuse victims for more than an hour. Interesting that that shows up today as we're about to have this conversation.
Yeah, and I have to say that a lot of the background material in, especially Ruby Crystal, has basically all come out in the major media. Like, as an author, in order to illustrate where we were, I have a whole issue in all three books of contemporary time moving along as the characters are alive, and then all this depth going into the past. And so, let's call it the current timeline. So with the current timeline, I had to select the most important things that were happening on the planet with the climate and with the wars in the Middle East and with sexual abuse. And what's interesting is every single case that was focused on in Ruby Crystal has now been publicized very, very widely. The most recent one being in Philadelphia, where there was just basically a sex pit was operating for about 10 years. And so I think it's interesting that the characters went after the really big issue there, big issues there.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. So I've just got one last question for you. Sarah, who was a Catholic, she was also a scholar. She suspected that Jesus came to Earth from another planet to seed a new religion of love and compassion. Do you think this is true?
Well, I think, did we talk about for a second about Paul Wallace, the Christian theologian?
If we do it very quickly, because we've got about 1 minute left.
I think other Christian scholars, thank God not me, are going after this with big time. And it has to do with the issue of the Elohim and who are the Elohim. And more Christian scholars are starting to think that they were extraterrestrials. So this job is to be done by somebody else. Thank you very much.
Barbara Hanclough, thank you for joining us. We're out of time. I really look forward to continuing the story next month when we will be discussing book 3.
Me too, Sandy.
Thank you. Revelations of the Aquarian Age is the second volume in Barbara Hanclough's The Revelations trilogy. And next month, Barbara will be back with us to discuss book 3, Revelations from the Source which offers an in-depth experience of alchemical transmutation to cleanse old parts of the psyche and clear space for the shift to 5D through 9D consciousness. The Revelations Trilogy is published by Inner Traditions, Bear & Company. And for more information about Barbara Han Clow, you can visit her website at handclow2012.com. That's it for this week. Thank you for your company. I hope you'll join me at the same time next week for another edition of What Is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me. And thank you again to Barbara Han Clow.